stories, at least 3 people are killed and 15 others wounded in yet another explosion targeting a mosque in Afghanistan, this time in the eastern province of Nangarhar. The UK's top court is hearing a complaint that senior British officers were involved in covering up the killings of Afghan civilians during the war in Afghanistan. Also ahead, Iran says the removal of US sanctions against Tehran is the main purpose of its upcoming talks with the remaining signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. My name is Arash Zahidi. Welcome to the program. Our top story, at least 3 people have been killed in a blast in Afghanistan's eastern province of Nangarhar. Medical sources say 15 others have been injured. A Taliban official said the blast targeted the Sunni mosque in Spinghar district while people were holding Friday prayers. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility. The explosion is the latest in a series of attacks carried out against mosques in Afghanistan since the Taliban's return to power in mid-August. More than 120 people were killed in 2 blasts in 2 Shia mosques in October. Daesh claimed responsibility for those attacks. Senior British military officers have been aware of a series of killings of Afghan men by British troops during the war in Afghanistan about a decade ago, but the officers failed to properly investigate those killings that in some cases involved unarmed Afghans. That's what the High Court has heard. The hearing began on Tuesday, lasting for 4 days. The claim is being made on behalf of Saifullah Yar, an Afghan man whose 4 male relatives were killed in a British Special Forces night raid in February 2011. The soldiers said they had acted in self-defense, accusing the men of carrying weapons. Saifullah's family denies that. His lawyers have now brought the case, saying there had been allegations of, quote, patterns of unlawful killings and a cover-up. Lawyers have asked for more documents relating to executions of, quote, fighting-age males by British troops. The Defense Ministry says it has already released enough documents. Back in 2014, the Ministry launched a probe into those executions examining 11 incidents, but the probe ended in 2019 without any prosecution. Iran's lead negotiator in the upcoming P4+1 talks in Vienna has met with officials from the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. Ali Bagheri Kani has described the meetings as positive, while reiterating Tehran's position that the talks will aim at the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions. Amina Taylor is in London.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bagheri Kani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK Foreign Ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Political commentator Jason Andrew believes all U.S. efforts at this point is dedicated to continuing its maximum pressure campaign on Iran rather than returning to the nuclear deal.
I think that the United States will only actually return to the JCPOA once it can cause further harm to Iran. Basically, what is in my opinion is that the current unjust sanctions that were placed by the previous U.S. administration are not going to be removed. Essentially, the U.S. is going to leave these sanctions in place and maybe even demand more. I mean, if the U.S. simply wanted to return honest and fairly, it really wouldn't have required seven rounds of talk. All they could do is simply return to the previous agreement with the previously agreed to levels of sanctions or no sanctions, etc. But it's very clear that the U.S. has not done that. So I think that this sends a definite message that the U.S. is not willing to act honorably or even in a most basic, decent manner. I think that the United States is going to continue to try to pressure Iran into accepting new sanctions or a new set of sanctions, etc. So I don't see the U.S. is going back to the regular deal. I think all U.S. effort at this point is dedicated towards trying to place, even more of this maximum pressure campaign on Iran, and it's not going to return to the original agreement.
The Syrian army has intercepted a U.S. military convoy in the northeastern province of Hasaka. According to local sources, the army confronted the U.S. convoy at a checkpoint near the city of Qamishli. The convoy, made up of five vehicles, was attempting to enter the city, but it was forced to turn back. Last month, local residents prevented another American military convoy from crossing through their village near Qamishli. Such incidents have repeatedly happened since the U.S. stationed its forces in northeast Syria in 2015. At the time, the U.S. said the deployment aimed to back Kurdish forces fighting the Daesh terror group. But Damascus has repeatedly called for an end to the U.S. presence, accusing Washington of stealing Syrian oil. Palestinian prisoner Mehdad al-Qawasmi ends his nearly 4 months of hunger strike after the Israeli regime decided to release him.
Mehdad's demand was quite normal as he refused to eat and drink, which is everyone's right. And it is his absolute right to enjoy freedom. When his right to freedom was violated and he went on hunger strike, he was quite sure about what he was doing and he knew that he was right. But unfortunately, we are living under tyranny and oppression, and he was arrested just because a local officer issued an order for his arrest without any legal justification. These people are truly free people, and they should be looked up to.
The Palestinian Prisoners Information Office said the regime has agreed to free Qawasmi in February next year. It said the agreement was reached after long negotiations between a group of Hamas prisoners and Israeli prison service. Qawasmi was on hunger strike for 113 days before being taken to the ICU due to his deteriorating conditions. Hamas has hailed the resistance, saying the decision to release him shows Israel's failure to discourage Palestinians from fighting for freedom. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon says Palestinians believe the great victory achieved by Mehdad al-Qawasmi against his Israeli captors is an achievement for all Palestinian nation.
Mehdad al-Qawasmi ended his nearly 4 months hunger strike, to be exact, 113 days, fighting the Israeli regime, fighting the so-called Israel prison service, which is in charge of 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers, holding around 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including women and children. Mehdad al-Qawasmi, according to Hamas, has scored a huge victory against his captors. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem said yesterday that al-Qawasmi's victory is a victory for all Palestinians and victory for all prisoners. The issue of Palestinian prisoners is highly emotive, Arash, for Palestinians, because they view them as political prisoners and as heroes of resistance against the Israeli occupation. Since 1967 alone, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians. And also, we have to mention that more than 50,000 of them were placed under the so-called administrative detention. And this is what Mirdad al-Qawasmi was fighting during his hunger strike. He was fighting this illegal and inhumane policy.
Hezbollah Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah says Israel is suffering from existential fear, mainly due to the strength of the resistance in Lebanon. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed that the resistance in Lebanon has prevented full U.S. hegemony over Lebanon and has prevented civil war. Underlining the achievements of the resistance, Syed Hassan Nasrallah said that one of the most tangible results is the fact that Israel is deterred from launching aggressions and even fears the strength of the resistance.
For the first time, Israel is living in a deeply rooted state of fear and concern for its existence. The elites in this entity are asking about the legitimacy of the entity's existence and the ability to exist. They are trying to get some oxygen through normalization of ties with some Arab states, but deep in their minds, the Israelis know that all these countries cannot protect their occupation or forts from the men of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the entire region.
Speaking at Hezbollah's Martyr Day celebration, Nasrallah said the main fear for the Israelis is that the resistance in Lebanon would invade the Galilee in northern occupied Palestine. Said Nasrallah also criticized the Saudi campaign against Lebanon, saying a sovereign state would not accept any foreign dictates. The real problem is the crisis the Saudis have in Yemen, he said. The only way to stop it is to accept a ceasefire and lift the siege. Representatives of Lebanese political factions consider that the sacrifices of the martyrs of the resistance in Lebanon are evident for the entire region.
This is a historic day, not just for the resistance in Lebanon, but also for all the people from the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon to Palestine. Had it not been for the martyrs, the entire region would have been destroyed. The Zionists and the Takfiris are the same, supported by the U.S. and Arab regimes. But we believe this sacred blood will liberate Palestine.
Families of the martyrs, for their part, stress that they would not back down. Sayyid Nasrallah also reiterated that as the resistance liberated Lebanon from Israeli occupation, their next goal is full sovereignty and freedom from U.S. hegemony. What began with the first martyrdom operation in November 1982 as a fight for freedom from Israeli occupation in Lebanon has transformed into a struggle for emancipation for the entire region. And what used to be a grassroots resistance in a small Mediterranean country is now backed by an alliance on a regional scale, ready to face new U.S.-Israeli threats. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain are taking part in a joint military drill with Israel and the U.S. a year after they normalized ties with Tel Aviv. The drill is taking place in the Red Sea. It began on Wednesday, running for 5 days. That's according to the U.S. Navy. It says the exercises included boarding, search, and seizure training. An Israeli naval officer says the drill could help counter what he calls Iran's power projection in the region. The exercises are the first publicly announced military cooperation between the four sides since Bahrain and the UAE established diplomatic ties with Israel last September. Manama and Abu Dhabi did so under U.S. brokered deals, which Palestinians see as a stab in their back. Political commentator Mr. Einar Tangen says the U.S. tries to form alliances with local players in various parts of the world where it faces challenges to its hegemonic ambitions from different sources, such as Iran and China.
Well, I don't think it's any coincidence that the U.S. is forming alliances in all areas where they think they have confrontation. They're now on basically a three-front situation. They have the Quad in trying to India, Australia, etc., Japan, trying to hem in the United States, China in the East. Obviously, Iran is the concern of the U.S., and they're trying to get these navies together and put them into some sort of war footing. And then you have NATO and Russia. So at this juncture, the U.S. is extending itself. It seems to want to bring in local players. But, you know, let us be realistic. None of these are massive seagoing powers. It's hard to see how anything would be coordinated. It would still fall on the U.S. Navy to do anything if there was, in fact, any kind of armed conflict. It's certainly the U.S. is pursuing the same strategy, regardless whether it's China, Iran, or Russia. They feel that they need to, quote, get a gang of other countries together who they can say, you know, are siding with them in their particular imposition of values or push for American hegemony.
Russia says it will act to defend its security if there is any threatening action by its opponents along its borders after the country detected six NATO flights over Black Sea in the last 24 hours. Russian government spokesman Dmitry Peskov described as provocative the increase in the activities of NATO in the Black Sea and the presence of Western spy planes. Peskov dismissed the Western media report on the U.S. concerns about Russia's possible attack on Ukraine. He said Russia has posed no threats to any country. Separately, the Russian Defense Ministry criticized the U.S. military activity in the Black Sea, saying it threatens regional and strategic stability. Belarus has threatened to retaliate against any new EU sanctions against Minsk, saying any such move will lead to shutting down of the transit of natural gas via his country.
We have increased the volumes of natural gas pumped via Belarus. The Yamal-Europe pipeline is full. We are heating Europe and they are threatening that they will close the border. And what if we block the supply of natural gas there? If they impose additional sanctions on us, indigestible and unacceptable for us, we must respond.
The warning comes amid a migrant crisis on the Belarusian border with EU member Poland. Lukashenko also claimed that the migrants on the border had been receiving weapons and explosives from conflict-hit eastern Ukraine. The president called on the Belarusian military to remain vigilant. Lukashenko was reacting to the EU threat that it would hit Belarus with fresh sanctions next week over the migrant crisis. Moss noted that there are other options on the table, including the expansion of current sanctions, especially the economic ones. Lukashenko, on the other hand, accuses the EU of trying to shift the blame on the country to justify its new sanctions. Meanwhile, Poland accused Minsk of state terrorism for allegedly using intimidation to force migrants to breach the border. Belarus, however, says Poland is violating international norms by blocking the migrants and beating them back with force. Thousands of asylum seekers remain stuck near the Belarusian border with Poland in freezing weather. Guards and police forces are deployed on the Polish side to block the migrants from entering into the EU.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
On the nuclear issue, the US has truly passed all limits in their brazenness. They have truly passed all limits in brazenness. They withdrew from the JCPOA in front of everyone. Now they speak as if it was Iran that withdrew from the JCPOA. And they make demands as if we are the ones who violated our commitments. For a long time, Iran did not react to this move made by the US. But after a while, and having announced it, we deliberately stopped fulfilling some of our commitments. We only stopped some, not all our commitments. they did not fulfill their commitments. European countries went along with the US too. From the point of view of breaking promises and showing malice, they are not any less than the US. They are like the US, but they have silver tongues and make extravagant demands. They are always making demands. They talk as if it was us who were mocking the negotiations for a long time and dishonored our commitments. This is what they did.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
And the current US administration is no different from the previous administration. In other words, what they want at the present time concerning the nuclear issue from Iran is the same thing that Trump wanted. At that time, the high-ranking officials of the country said that it was impossible, unreasonable, and such. Today, they want the same thing. There is no difference. Trump said it in one way, and the current administration says it in another way. We should pay attention to this. Behind the diplomatic scene, the US is truly a predatory wolf. In appearance, it is diplomacy. They smile, speak, and sometimes talk with self-righteousness. But in reality, they are a savage, vicious wolf that shows itself in many parts of the world.
Midstream.
The scenes presented by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy of them thwarting the American attempt to hijack an Iranian oil tanker in the Sea of Oman are so immensely important that I doubt just one episode is enough for me to emphasize their significance. Footage released by the Iranian state TV showed units of guard boats aiming their weapons at an American warship and forcing them to withdraw from the spot of these units while they were leading and directing the Iranian tanker were not normal. The incident is worth stopping and thinking thoroughly about in terms of the level of engagement and the specificity of the parties involved. Also, in terms of the sensitivity of the location of the standoff in the Sea of Oman and what it means in terms of the open confrontation between Iran and its opponents in that region. The noteworthy point which deserves focus in follow-up and analysis goes beyond the apparent event in itself. The operation itself could be placed in the category of special maneuvers carried out by airborne units that carried out a landing of an airborne group on the surface of the oil tanker, forcing the tanker's crew to head towards the depths of the Iranian territorial waters. All of this took place in an open, controlled, and monitored area within the dominion of the U.S. 5th Fleet units in the Sea of Oman, which operated based on their naval, missile, and air capabilities. However, the Revolutionary Guard Corps units in the second phase of their operation, which was based on expelling U.S. naval vessels from the area and through their quick reaction and immediate response to deal with an emergency and unfamiliar event, proved that they were distinguished by remarkable readiness. The sensitivity of the Iranian intervention through this special operation and the readiness of its navy will inevitably be more dangerous for the U.S. in the event of another confrontation that might just escalate into a broader clash. Hence, Iran was able to emphasize that it is a key and influential player in one of the most sensitive areas in the world. Indeed, it has proven to be the undisputed first player in a strategic clash scene in which the most powerful forces at an international level are involved. Iran asserted that when its interests, national security, and status are exposed to any danger or targeting, it is ready to go above and beyond whatever the level of confrontation is. At a time when we see major powers finding it difficult to confront U.S. influence, whose army is ranked among the strongest in the world, we see that Iran considers confrontation a responsibility, a duty, a right, and a valid option. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The United States continues to play pirates in the Persian Gulf waters through an Iranian-American naval battle which occurred last month in the Sea of Oman when American forces seized one of its oil tankers before the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy was able to recover it with an airdrop, as we saw last week. While U.S. officials have conveyed a completely different story from the Iranian one, saying that Tehran is the one who is holding a Vietnamese-flagged tanker, it seems that all doors were shut to the possibility of reducing tensions between the two sides, especially with America brandishing alternative options, perhaps military ones, they say, forgetting who they are actually going up against. Pentagon first denied that this showdown actually took place, but they were then hit hard when the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps released video footage of the encounter just last week. The footage focuses on Iranian movements to board and direct the ship's course and omits the earlier attempts by U.S. troops to seize the oil. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Mohammad Sultan Nejad, academic and researcher at Tehran University. Thanks a million for being with us, Dr. Sultan Nejad. Now, the conflict between the Iranian and the American accounts regarding the tanker incident in the Sea of Oman will for sure just exacerbate tension between both sides. However, can the Pentagon still refuse, how can they just refute the Iranian narrative and the Iranian story after the visual evidence presented to the entire world by the Iranian state TV?
Okay, thank you for having me. As you just said, we have just conflicting narratives by Iranian and the American sides about this incident. The thing is that at least Iran has shown some evidence to be relied upon, and this is visualized how the things have gone. So this is something that we can at least see some evidence supporting that. But American narrative seems like unsubstantiated, and I have not seen anything more than some claims about what they have said about their own side of the story. The thing is that I think totally what is disappointing is the United States' type of reaction to the waters close to Iran. And this is something that would just make things much worse. And in my opinion, there was like a problem resolved that the United States revoked it. And then by such actions of, as you said, can be termed piracy. They are trying to make things even worse and just proposing some narratives that they are not acceptable and they cannot support it. So I'm regretted about what I see in this condition. I think the United States could act more responsibly if it kept its pledges towards Iran in accordance the nuclear deal, and they didn't hesitate to revive the nuclear deal after the Trump went. And now we see the two countries in such escalations that I don't think would bear any fruits.
Dr. Sultan-Najjad, something interesting was said by the Americans after the incident where Washington actually issued a threat last week through its Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, that it might resort to what it called alternative options, maybe including military ones, against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Is that an inevitable option if the two sides fail in the upcoming agreement or in the upcoming talks to try and revive the agreement of the JCPOA?
Well, I think that option would be a remote possibility regarding the facts on the ground. I don't think the United States has the stomach to do such a thing about Iran. Not that the United States does not have the military power for that, but the consequences would be, you know, very high for the United States, and we all know that Iran has a formidable military, and Iran can retaliate in very strong ways. Iran has shown its ability to respond to the United States' aggressions in the past. Just I make a reference to what Iran did with launching the missiles for the United States bases in Iraq that led to brain injury for many number of Americans. And this was a fact that was seen by the world. So the United States actually hesitates to do such a thing. And again, I would see that if the United States does this and Iran would respond, it would have like these escalation mounted between the two countries, which is very destructive, especially for the United States, because it is alien to their region, and the United States is already entangled in conflicts in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. The United States has recently managed to take out its troops from Afghanistan, and it would be unwise to start a new war in the region, particularly with a country like Iran, with a formidable military and also a population that is opposed to any foreign interference. So I do not think that option would just be materialized by the United States. There is a wisdom in the United States, and the fact that the United States has resorted to negotiations with Iran, and negotiations went on, the United States actually during the Trump administration has this rationality to recognize Iran's rise. It was just out of the United States' desire to avoid such a destructive eventuality. So I do not think that
Dr. Sultan-Najjad, Iran requires for the reversal of steps that were taken by the United States of America for its nuclear program, a complete lifting of the sanctions. This is what Iran wants, because they are basically unilateral, punitive U.S. Measures here in order for them to actually join back the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. While Washington refuses to make any concessions in this regard, who has the higher bargaining hand here, and what is more pressuring measures that we can expect out of the Biden administration?
Well, again, I'm sorry that you're in such a situation that you're talking about these measures and countermeasures, about these leverages. Well, I think there would be much better options, but now that the United States has created such a bad situation and they're continuing this way down to like escalation with Iran, I would say that eventually Iran would have the upper hand, because you know Iran has many options. That when Iran is restricting access of to some sites by for the international observers, it means that there are other sites that would be restricted by Iran upon a political decision. And then also you would see that Iran can increase its enrichment, its uranium enrichment level. It's already 60%. It can go higher and higher. The number of centrifuges, the kind of centrifuges can be improved. And all this would work like a leverage for Iran. And it is in a time that the United States has consumed all its options. Actually, the United States has implemented what it calls crippling sanctions towards Iran. But despite these sanctions, you would see that the country is going on. There is a heavy pressure on the economy.
So basically, What you're saying is very, very important, but basically in 30 seconds, because we're actually out of time, but in 30 seconds, then why is this kind of negotiating talks important, or what's the actual point out of it if the U.S. cannot commit itself to anything?
Well, I think it's a matter of legitimacy generation and legitimacy maintenance for Iran. I think Iran has a moral high ground here. Iran has a moral high ground. Everybody knows that Iran is just doing the right thing. Iran has kept its pledges towards the world community. We have all seen how Iran behaved vis-a-vis the United States, unlawful behaviors. So legally, again, Iran has the upper hand. So international legal instruments would support what Iran has done while condemning the United States' unilateral action of withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Then again, in the political scene, you would see that there are countries that are supporting Iran's cause. Politically, Iran has, the high ground here. China is working with Iran, Russia is working with Iran, Europeans, despite their cooperation with the United States, but at least they are ready to just put some sort of political pressures on the White House to resume its commitments. Well, so I think
It seems that we are looking upon some very important couple of months to come between the Islamic Republic of Iran and its U.S. counterpart. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mohammad Sultan Nejad, academic and professor at Tehran University, for joining us on this matter. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, U.S. State Department notified Congress of a new $650 million arms sale to Saudi Arabia last week. The sale comes as the Biden administration continues to grapple with the U.S.-Saudi relationship that has been strained in recent years following the murder of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi and Saudi Arabia's involvement in its absurd war on Yemen. Now, the sale will include 280 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles, which the State Department said are used for air defense capabilities and cannot be used to attack ground targets. U.S. lawmakers have criticized Riyadh for its involvement in the war on Yemen, while the U.S. is up to its neck in this conflict, which is considered one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters. These same U.S. lawmakers have refused to approve many military sales for the kingdom without assurances that U.S. equipment would not be used to kill civilians. Well, Yemeni cemeteries say otherwise, but when have U.S. officials ever said the truth? Biden reneges on vow to sell arms to Saudi Arabia in this following report.
In less than a week, the U.S. administration approved two arms deals to Saudi Arabia under the pretext of supporting the territorial defense of Saudi Arabia. It is not excluded that the two deals are a leap from the deteriorating relations between the Joe Biden administration and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, which have recently declined further as Washington blamed Riyadh for the high oil prices. The administration's approval of two U.S. arms deals to Saudi Arabia totaling $1.15 billion also coincided with rapid developments on the Yemeni oil and gas-rich Ma'arib front, where the Army Forces and the People's Committees and the Yemeni resistance on Sarullah took control of all the governorate's districts, with the exception of Ma'arib district, which includes the city of Ma'arib, the governorate's center, and the Wadi district. The resistance is now closer than ever to defeating the Saudi-Emirati alliance and its Western backers in the more than six-year-old war, which may explain the dispatch of the American envoy to Yemen, Timothy Lenderking, to the region, where his visits are limited to times when Saudi Arabia feels cornered and defeated to try and salvage the situation. The U.S. Department of Defense had announced last week that the State Department informed Congress its approval of a $650 million deal with Saudi Arabia, which includes 280 AIM-120C medium-range air-to-air missiles. According to the State Department, these missiles are supposed to be used for defense purposes and cannot be used to, quote, attack targets on the ground, unquote, and is fully in line with the administration's pledge to engage in diplomacy, wait for it, to end the conflict in Yemen. I really fail to understand how any of this statement is compatible with simple common sense. But when has America's foreign policy ever made any sense? This deal is the second for Saudi Arabia under the Biden administration. Last week, the U.S. State Department notified Congress its approval of another $500 million military support services package. At the time, the State Department said the proposed transaction will support the foreign policy and national security objectives of the United States by helping to enhance the security of a friendly nation that remains an important force for political stability and economic growth in the Middle East. But the agreement, which includes support for the ongoing maintenance of a wide range of helicopters, including a future fleet of Boeing CH-47 Chinook aircrafts, violates Biden's pledge because these aircrafts are offensive ones. They are used to launch AIM-120 air-to-air missiles. To justify this, the State Department claimed that this deal would also provide protection for American soldiers and more than 70,000 American citizens working inside the kingdom, which in reality supports Saudi military aggression against Yemen rather than works to end it.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Washington is Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz, author and former Secretary General of the Arab National Conference. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Ziad. Now, after it had withheld from selling weapons to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the U.S. State Department has approved the sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued up to $650 million, with another package that was also approved last week up to $550 million for Saudi Arabia. So instead of actually pressuring Mohammed bin Salman to at least stop or halt the war, his aggression against Yemen, Biden just gave him 280 more weapons to ignite it even further. How is that finding peace in Yemen, as Biden always likes to say?
And thank you for having me on your program. And I think what you have said in your presentation of this segment is totally correct, that hardly ever U.S. foreign policy has made sense. I think the Biden administration is no different from previous administrations, where it says one thing and does exactly the opposite. Because in this particular instance, for instance, the Biden administration is the result of a coalition of forces that have conflicting agendas, and these forces have put him in the White House. But now, chicken have come to roost, so to speak. And let's say the military-industrial complex or the companies that manufacture arms are requiring their pound of flesh, so to speak. And this goes against the peace between quotation marks rhetoric that he was trying to advocate to end the peace, to end the war in Yemen, as well as his colleagues in the Democratic Party in Congress. But the realities on the ground say otherwise, that they have to pay heed to those donors who have made them what they are when they were facilitated the reach to power. The second thing is, in the actual tension that exists between the administration and the Crown Prince, we have seen it reach to almost a climax last week in Lebanon, where the Crown Prince has declared for all intents and purposes an economic war on Lebanon, mm-hmm. and is forcing the council, the Gulf members of the to follow suit and join into the blockade, economic blockade of Lebanon. This goes against to the strategy of the United States and Lebanon that wants to keep it as it is and not having it collapse, because otherwise it will go indirectly into the sphere of influence of Iran and Hezbollah, and this is what it doesn't want. What
we saw is pretty much either a confusion in the Biden administration or actually a strategy, a new strategy by Biden. Trump administration's friendly, very friendly, if I may, relationship with Mohammed bin Salman and Riyadh, the Biden administration kind of recalculated their approach to Saudi Arabia, which is a country with severe human rights violations. But they are Washington's closest allies in West Asia. So is this Biden's way of maybe upping the ante against Iran, who he will have talks with maybe soon enough?
Well, yes and no. I mean, don't forget that this stance towards Saudi Arabia started with the Obama administration when he wanted to recalibrate the whole Middle East, and that was the foundation of the Arab Spring. And the Arab petromonarchies in the Gulf were next in line, so to speak, to follow suit. But it didn't happen. Trump had a personal good relation with the Crown Prince and Saudi Arabia, but that doesn't mean that the administration followed suit and also that the Congress followed suit. So you have to be a little bit careful about how we define the relationship between the various administrations. Biden is a continuation of Obama's administration in that term of having, different perspective from previous administrations about the relationship with Saudi Arabia. Suddenly, for ideological purposes or for any other purpose, the issues of human rights, political freedoms, etc., is becoming at the forefront of his policy with petromonarchies. And I don't think it's going to succeed, because real politics requires that he follows another track. And I don't think there is a strategy in the United States or in the Foreign State Department. They are pragmatic to the point of responding to events on a day-to-day basis without a clear view of what's going to happen next. And this has happened since the invasion of Iraq, where they have lost the initiative and they have become subservient to the events on the ground initiated by their opponents, and they have to decide to how to respond to that. In the present situation, with the various, let's say, hot dossiers that the United States is facing in the region, the discussion with Iran, the issue with Hezbollah, and the war on Yemen, at the center of all this is the security of the state of Israel. So all the policies of the United States are guided to help Israel, which is in a difficult situation because of its inability.
Does this analysis actually maybe support the point of the U.S. envoy to Yemen, Tim Lenderking's visit? He just landed in the region bearing an initiative apparently aimed at reversing the developments that Ansarullah did in the northern city of Ma'rib in Yemen. Why is it so important for the U.S. that the Yemeni resistance stays put and not fully take Ma'rib?
Because for geostrategic purposes, if you take Ma'rib, you also control the whole of Yemen, and when you control the whole of Yemen, you control the entrance to the Red Sea, and that is a geostrategic no-no for the United States, because all the Red Sea, the Suez Canal, and the access to Europe from that ceiling becomes in the hands of hostile powers to the United States. And that's why it is extremely important for the United States to keep, in the best case scenario, Yemen from falling to the hands of its opponents, and in the worst case scenario, to keep the war dragging as much as possible so nobody can have a direct claim on that geostrategic position, notwithstanding the fact that Yemen is sitting on an ocean of oil and gas, which in contrast or compared to those of the Saudi Arabia, no new discoveries have been made in Saudi Arabia, and therefore it's facing the issue of depletion of reserves. Whereas in Yemen, you may have a new boon for the oil industry. And that's why the issue of Yemen is not just a passing fade and has extremely important strategic importance.
This gives a lot of points, Dr. Hafiz, for how Yemen might actually be the rock that Saudi Arabia might stumble on in the region of the Arabian Peninsula. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ziad Hafez, former Secretary General of the Arab National Conference, for joining us from Washington to talk about the new U.S. arms deal with the Al Saud in the Arabian Peninsula. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint, a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. In this series of programs, Viewpoint, or the movie critique program, we are mainly focusing on the religious concepts rather than the artistic features typical of so-called critical programs about arts and artistic characteristics of the movies. So our main purpose is to address those features and themes which are related about religion and God and whatsoever that goes with that territory. And it's me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, as always. And my two brothers, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah, are joining us again And Assalamu alaikum, Brother Hussein. Welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam. Glad to be here.
And Sayyid Abdullah, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. And thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, it's a while that we've been criticizing the movie and Interview with God, but I guess we need to finish it off in this episode or the next one, and hopefully in this one. Let me ask you the question after listening to a part of the movie, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
All right, let me put it in a biblical context. In the early days, men were wicked.
Yes, and that didn't work out too well for them.
No, salvation wasn't possible then, like it is now. But I gave you another chance, a new set of rules.
Moses.
That's right. Now, the law was clear, but still the path to me was indirect and difficult. But all that changed one day long ago in Bethlehem. And it was good news, but it was also the start of a new covenant, a new way.
Yes.
For example, Moses had 10 commandments, but later, Jesus only mentioned 6 on 2 occasions.
I know the controversy.
Yes. Now, when asked how a man can enter heaven, Jesus said, "You shall not murder. You shall not steal. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not bear false witness. Honor thy father and mother. Love your neighbor as yourself."
In Matthew and Mark, yes, I know.
He left 4 off the list.
The first 4, yes, I know.
Yes, the 4 that deal with man's relationship to God. Now, what does that tell you?
You've been listening to a part of the movie, An Interview with God, that we've been trying to criticize here in this program, the movie critique program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. Sayyid Abdullah, this part in the movie that we just listened to, and it's talking about the early days that, you know, this, in fact, conversation happens in the last part or the last interview that Paul had with the person claiming to be God. Well, there is the reference or the mention of a changing world. And because of that, the rules get changed, even by God. In the Old Testament, there is the mention of 10 commandments, mm-hmm. right? But when it comes to Jesus, we are left with 6 rules. As if the first 4 rules that are pertaining to the relationship between man and God is like gone or left out. All right? Yeah. Is it really necessary, or is it because of the changing circumstances of the world that rules need to be revisioned or revised or get changed?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We have a saying in our theology that al-Islamu yajibu ma qabla, that the religion of Islam overrides the religion before it.
Yes.
So as we all know that every time, as time progresses, you're going to have new things, and new things will require new laws. So the laws, they have to keep updating themselves to meet the demands of the creation. Right, so you cannot apply the laws, for example, of Christianity or Judaism back in the day to today, and so on and so forth. So you need a religion that's always comprehensive in a way that always meets the demands of the people. So, for example, even from an Islamic perspective, back in the day we did not have, let's say, social media, right? Now we have social media, for example, we have space travel, we have so many things that requires laws. Well, back in the day, they had no Snapchat, so the Prophet wouldn't know what's the ruling when it comes to Snapchat. So you see that, but the ulama, because Islam is very flexible, so the laws keep changing, and we have creation of new laws as time progresses. But in that movie specifically, they were not talking about the laws. They were talking about the commandments. And what they omitted, so between the Old Testament and the New Testament, he said the first 4, which was you should not, you know, take partners to God, you should believe in the one God, and this and that. But he left the rest, which is, you know, be good to your neighbor, be good to your parents, be good to that.
Yes.
So these ones stayed, but they omitted the first 3 or 4 important ones, which is the core of any religion, which is God himself.
Exactly.
So it makes no sense that why would you take these important elements out of the equation? Because they're trying to give you the idea, the image, that, look, at the end of the day, as long as you're a good person, that should be sufficient. You know, be good to your neighbor, don't kill, don't steal, this and that. That should suffice, even if you don't believe in a God. Where God himself, he said, well, back in the day, I was a bit strict. So I had to, you know, everyone has to do exactly what I, you know, what I told them. But now things change, so I had to. We say this is just nonsense. Because even goodness itself, you know, being good to your neighbor, not stealing, not killing, what does that stem from? If you don't have a belief in a God himself, then what holds you accountable?